It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi again, everybody. Before we get to this raft of gun-related stories in the news in the last 24 hours, later this hour we're going to talk about a super cool project from the New Museum in which every payphone in Manhattan, yes, there are still some, has been turned into a storytelling booth. And we need your help. We're looking for a few volunteers to go to your nearest payphone anytime before 11:40, so, you know, in the next half hour, 35 minutes, and dial the following number, 1-855-4-1993. That's 1-855-FOR-1993. And what you will get is a story about the neighborhood that you're in 20 years ago in 1993. After you listen to it, pick up your cell phone at about 20 of the hour, and call us to report on what you learned. More instructions are on our website if you want to check this out, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll also find a map of all the payphones in Manhattan that the New Museum put together. So you can get a map of all the payphones in Manhattan. And again, we're looking for some volunteers from anywhere in Manhattan to take part in this payphone project and report in around 11:40. You dial the following number and you will get a recording. And my voice is on some of these. If you're in Tribeca or the Upper West Side or Inwood, you'll actually hear my voice. You'll hear other narrators for other parts of Manhattan at 1-855-FOR-1993. 1-855-FOR-1993. And then call in if you've actually done this when we do the segment on it in about a half hour. All right. Connecticut now has a strong gun control bill to match New York's. Both post-Newtown bills are among the toughest in the nation, even as President Obama continues to struggle in his quest to get legislation at the federal level. The NRA took another step in its Armed Guards in Schools campaign yesterday. That's another story. And the NRA is vigorously opposing now an arms control treaty approved at the UN yesterday, even though the only countries to vote against it were Iran, North Korea, and Syria. With us for a whirlwind tour of the day's breaking gun news is Paul Barrett, editor at Bloomberg News and author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Good to be here.
And I find the politics of this arms control treaty the most fascinating thing. So let's start there. The treaty is designed to keep conventional military weapons out of the hands of criminals. Do you have the list? I'll look it up if you don't have it. But do you have the list of what conventional military weapons we're talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about everything from the, you know, the ordinary rifles that soldiers carry up to artillery and quite heavy duty stuff like tanks. So it's a wide range of weaponry.
But it's pretty much military weaponry, right? A whole different category from our domestic gun control debate and the things that it covers?
Yes, this is a different set of weapons. There would be some overlap. I mean, soldiers do carry handguns, and some of the rifles might be similar to the ones we debate when we talk about the lawful ownership of firearms by civilians. But this is, on the whole, a much more potent arsenal that we're talking about.
Now, the NRA is getting involved, and I read on their site that one of their concerns is that weapons of war would be inventoried by each government in their countries. So the NRA fears the U.S. government will start keeping a list of citizens who own guns. Does the treaty suggest that might happen?
Well, the treaty includes prefatory language that strikes me as designed to preclude exactly that danger. The treaty has language that says that this is explicitly not about the intranational, the domestic regulation of firearms within any country. It leaves to each individual country the job of regulating how they allow or don't allow their citizenry to be armed. The NRA argument, I think, is quite similar to many of the NRA arguments, which is to say it's a slippery slope argument. They're saying what the proposed law, or in this case treaty, says on its face is not what you need to fear. What you need to fear is the next step and the next step and the step after that.
And so, for example, here is David Keene, president of the NRA, on this UN arms treaty.
The more serious threat is the UN arms trade treaty, which the president and his people will tell your viewers does not affect the rights of people in the United States. It does. It requires an international registry of firearms. It charges all signatory countries to set up a regime of firearms ownership and registration in their country consistent with the treaty. And it could be used to prevent sporting arms to be imported into the United States.
David Keene speaking about that back in February. How about that last point that he mentioned? Because I think you already addressed the first one, that the treaty could be used to prevent sporting arms importation into the U.S.
Well, he did use the word could. He didn't say the treaty bans or restricts the importation of sporting arms. And again, the whole treaty is worded and set up to allow signatory countries to monitor sales of weapons. It doesn't actually ban the sale of weapons. It says we don't want weapons to be sold to bad guys. Moreover, the treaty contains no language, zero language at the moment, that indicates how it's going to be enforced. For the moment, this is a largely symbolic gesture. So I just don't really follow Mr. Keene's reasoning when he says that the treaty is going to, in some way, prevent a gun wholesaler in the United States from importing a Beretta shotgun manufactured in Italy.
But the politics of this seem to be that the only three countries to vote against the treaty yesterday were Iran, Syria, and North Korea. But here in the United States, because of NRA opposition and these issues that they're raising, a number of U.S. senators have already come out and said they're going to try to block ratification of this treaty in this country. So does the NRA have enough clout in the Senate to probably accomplish that?
Well, I would just amend one small part of your premise, which is I wouldn't give the NRA all the credit for controlling the Senate in any sense. I mean, these are duly elected members of the upper house of our legislature, and I think a lot of these guys genuinely agree with the NRA. It's not that the NRA is forcing them to adopt the gun lobby's position. That said, we have much more than just a few members of the Republican Party. We have a solid majority of the Senate, including a half a dozen Democrats, who have already taken a sense of the Senate vote, saying that if the treaty gets approved by the UN, we will oppose it when and if it gets to the United States Senate for ratification. So we actually already know the result. This is not being ratified with the present membership of the United States Senate.
Even though the aim of the treaty is really to keep dangerous weapons out of the hands of war criminals in other countries.
Absolutely. Its proponents say that the point is to keep weapons away from those who might perpetrate genocide, terrorists, war criminals, and other no-goodniks. But that doesn't wash in American gun politics. In our supercharged ideological gun politics, any move to restrict gun ownership is seen as a threat against the entire institution of firearm ownership, and that's the way this treaty, for better or for worse, will be interpreted by a majority of the members of the Senate. And remember, to ratify a treaty, you actually need a two-thirds vote, not just a majority vote. So I don't think there's any chance at all of this treaty being ratified. And the White House has already signaled they're not even sending it to the Senate anytime soon. Mm.
By the way, before we go on to some of these other gun control items in the news, we did an April Fool's gag on the show on Monday about a fictitious gun rights group proposing a constitutional right to bear drones, personal weaponized drones. But the satire underlying the gag was, some of you just got it? Oh, that was an April Fool's. Yeah, it was. But the satire underlying the gag was about the push to own military-style weapons in our private lives. You know, people say the AR-15s are military or aren't military, and that's a debate. So let me ask the question, where is the line? The Constitution does not specify a right to only own non-military weapons. In fact, the point is supposed to be to have a militia at the ready. So why have they drawn the line at semi-automatic as opposed to, say, fully automatic machine guns or missile launchers, which I think are specifically covered by this treaty, or tanks or any other weapon of war an American wants to own?
Yeah, well, we do have a line. It's not a particularly sharp line. In 2008, the United States Supreme Court, really for the first time in its entire history, grappled with the central meaning of the Second Amendment, and the resolution a narrow five-member conservative majority came up with was that one thing we know is you cannot ban the possession in the home of a handgun, that that's going too far. But in writing that very important landmark opinion, Justice Scalia said that we are not saying today that it is improper for government to regulate the ownership of firearms. So the Supreme Court clearly said that there is plenty of room for government to impose regulations. I would assume that anti-aircraft missiles could be regulated. In fact, we've had laws on the books that regulate the ownership and acquisition of fully automatic weapons for a long time. And my guess is that if that law were challenged, if gun rights activists hired lawyers and challenged the restrictions on the ownership of machine guns, that the Supreme Court, even this Supreme Court, a majority conservative Supreme Court, would uphold the current restrictions on machine guns.
Paul Barrett, my guest, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. As we look at a whole host of gun stories in the news in the last 24 hours. And let's move on. Connecticut now has a tough new gun regulation law at the state level, rivaling New York's new law for possibly the toughest in the nation. Governors Cuomo and Malloy here sounding similar notes.
This is a gun control bill, if you will, that actually exercises common sense.
This is a sweeping piece of legislation that will move us in the direction of being a safer state.
Malloy yesterday, Cuomo a few weeks ago, and the New York law passed. Do these two state laws essentially try to regulate guns in the same way, Paul?
Roughly speaking, they do. They expand restrictions on the military-style semi-automatic rifles that are frequently referred to as assault weapons. They expand and make more aggressive restrictions on large-capacity ammunition magazines. They also put in place new regulations having to do with mental health and when officials are required to act on information that someone might be dangerous as a result of mental illness. So in those senses, the laws are similar. They move in the same direction. And I think it is fair to say that these recently enacted laws, well, actually they're voting today in Connecticut, mm-hmm. Put these two states at the forefront in terms of the degree to which firearms are regulated. But having said that, it's important to also note that a variety of cities like New York City, like Washington, like Chicago, have had far more aggressive regulation of firearms for many, many years. So while these are important at the state level, a number of big cities have had very, very strict gun control for a long time.
Now, New York had a democracy problem with its bill. The governor and a few legislative leaders rammed it through without public debate. Connecticut took more time. Do you think the fact that Connecticut actually had a democratic process before the legislature got to today's vote resulted in any differences between the two states' bills in terms of content?
Oh, well, we know that they resulted in some differences. For example, on the topic of ammunition capacity, Connecticut enacted a 10-round limit. New York, as you said, in its rather precipitous legislative process, which lasted all of 72 hours, put in place a 7-round limit. Now, the governor has already backed off that and acknowledged that a 7-round limit makes no sense because no manufacturer's make ammunition magazines with only 7 rounds in them. 10 rounds is a standard amount, and I think Connecticut will be accomplishing whatever they're trying to accomplish in a way that will be effective, whereas New York is going to now have to go back and fiddle around with the law, some degree of embarrassment for the governor and his allies as a result of rushing things. In the end, though, I don't think that that's terribly important. I think the states have accomplished more or less what they set out to accomplish.
That mistake on the magazines was born of both haste and ignorance in New
Absolutely.
York. Lawmakers not knowing what kind of magazines are actually manufactured. Am I right, though, that the Connecticut legislature debated whether to actually confiscate existing magazines over the 10-round capacity and then decided to simply stop future sales?
That you just stated it correctly.
Do either of these laws affect the gun you wrote your book about, the Glock?
Well, they would affect the sale in the future of large-capacity handguns as well as large-capacity rifles, and the Glock's claim to fame, really, its original distinguishing characteristic was its large ammo capacity. The basic Glock model has a 17-round magazine, so in New York and now in Connecticut, it would be impossible to buy new 17-round basic Glock magazines. However, as you pointed out in the prior question, neither state is confiscating this equipment. There is a very large supply already in private hands, and as long as those gun owners follow the new rules, they will be able to keep those large magazines, as they will be able to keep the weapons they already have, one would hope, in their gun safes.
So how meaningful do you think either of these state laws are if the biggest number of illegal guns in New York come from states with looser laws like Pennsylvania and Virginia? Is it mostly just symbolic without a federal standard?
You know, now you get into a very interesting and subjective question of what is important and what will actually have a real effect on the ground as opposed to some symbolic significance. On the one hand, these states have passed laws that could never be passed at the national level because of Republican political influence in Congress, egged on by the NRA. On the other hand, I don't think any of these laws are going to have any significant effect on crime rates anytime soon. So we should not pretend that these are really blunt crime-fighting tools. These are largely regulations that apply to how you can lawfully acquire guns, and criminals, for the most part, are not walking into Main Street gun stores to acquire their guns, certainly not in the states of Connecticut and New York. That's just not where they get them. They get them on the street.
So last question, because I want to get to this NRA proposal for an armed guard in every school. Again, a proposal that would result in more sales for gun manufacturers who are NRA members just as individuals are. They proposed this right after Newtown. Why is it in the news again today?
The schools thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's in the news today because the NRA panel, headed by former Congressman Asa Hutchinson, came back with their, you know, rather lengthy report, delivering the results that the NRA fully expected and foreshadowed in their initial press conference after Newtown, which is to say, they see as being the most direct way to deal with the problem of the threat of mass shootings in schools, having armed personnel in schools. So it's in the news because it's a manufactured photo op style event in Washington, and we all decided to cover it.
All right. Paul Barrett, who's an editor covering things at Bloomberg and author of the book Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Very informative, as always. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, New York City Deputy Mayor Cass Holloway on how to get post-Sandy block grant money for your block or your home. Stay with us.